Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. Our guest this week is American physicist Donald Gurnett. Though he's still active as a researcher, Dr. Gurnett retired from the University of Iowa in 2019 after spending 60 years there as a student, teaching professor, and researcher. He's a pioneer in the field of space plasma physics, who has helped discover phenomena from lightning on the cloud decks of Jupiter to predicting quite accurately where the influence of the sun's electromagnetic interactions with space ends and where the interstellar medium begins, which was confirmed when the Voyager 1 spacecraft entered interstellar space in 2012. Don Gurnett joined us from his home in Iowa recently to talk about his life and work. Donald Gurnett, welcome to Blue Dot.
Okay, thank you very much for the introduction.
Your story is so fascinating to me. When I look at some of it, you happen to just be born at the right time in history to do some amazing things. So can you take us back to when you were like a teenager and you really had some interest in like flight and building model rockets and stuff like that, didn't you?
Yeah, that's true, actually. It turned out when I was a young kid, I joined a model airplane club up in Cedar Rapids, and it was about half kids my age, and the other half of the club was adults, what I'd now call mentors, and they were mostly from Collins Radio. And as it turned out, that was in an era when, you know, you could. Radio control really kind of didn't exist. You can go down to a hobby shop now and buy a radio control unit for a model airplane, and you just plug it together and it works. But it turned out that club, all these Collins radio people were sort of experimenting with tube radios, which you had to build yourself to try to control a model airplane, actually just a rudder. So I got very involved in that, and I learned a lot of electronics, even built electronics in high school. And that had a real impact on my career, too. And I have to tell you, there was a German rocket scientist. His name was Alexander Lippisch. And in World War II, he designed a Messerschmitt 163, which was a rocket-powered German fighter that they operated during the war. And he ended up working for Collins Radio, and he had quite an influence on my life too, because, you know, here I am, a young kid, 8 or 10 years old, I guess, and there's this German rocket scientist who'd come out and talk to us.
Yeah, wasn't he one of the, like, the pioneers of the Delta Wing, swept wing, you know, supersonic aircraft? Wasn't he kind of a pioneer in that field?
Yeah, that's correct. He was the first person back in, I think, the 1930s to fly a delta wing-shaped aircraft, which has some kind of special aerodynamic features. And he's often quoted as being the father of the Concorde. You know, it has a delta-shaped wing. Yeah, he's a very famous. At that time, I wanted to become an aeronautical engineer, but I got sidetracked onto my interest on electronics.
It amazes me to think of this, that at age 17, you were at the University of Iowa. How did that happen?
Well, yes, it turned out I graduated from high school in 1957, and I decided to go to the University of Iowa. Actually, I was going to go into electrical engineering because of this interest that developed in high school in electronics. And I arrived here at the University of Iowa in roughly September 20th, 1957. And I don't know, that's a famous year. I don't know if you remember.
Yeah, of course, Sputnik.
Sputnik 1 was launched on, I think it was October 4th of 1957. It was just a few weeks after I arrived here. And of course, in high school, I'd read a lot, and I knew about the possibility of an orbiting spacecraft. And even in high school, I'd actually built rockets with saltpeter, charcoal, and sulfur. That was kind of the Lippisch influence, actually. And so I was very impressed with Sputnik 1, just unbelievably impressed, as was the nation. I mean, we had this Russian object flying over us, and that was in the middle of the Cold War, which had a tremendous impact on the United States. It showed we were behind in rocketry and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, and it's interesting to me, too, to think of you winding up at the University of Iowa, because for most of our listeners are probably not aware of this, at that time, that early time in the space program, like around late 50s, early 60s, the University of Iowa was a center for space research because of a certain Dr. James Van Allen. Tell us how you got to know him.
Well, that is certainly correct. Now, I actually did not know Van Allen at that point. He had been during the 50s flying rockets, sounding rockets, studying cosmic rays, for example. And I think he was certainly known in the scientific community, but he wasn't publicly so well known. But as it turned out, because of that experience, he had been collaborating with Wernher von Braun, who you probably recognize, a German scientist that came to the United States and worked at Redstone Arsenal down at Huntsville. And Van Allen had gotten involved in flying cosmic ray instruments on V2s, captured V2s that were brought to the United States. So he was involved with von Braun in that respect. And then, of course, after the launch of Sputnik 1, there was a tremendous pressure for the United States to catch up and do something to catch up with the Russians. And as luck would have it, von Braun had a rocket called the Redstone had been under development down at the Redstone Arsenal. And they had even gone as far as figuring out how to put a spacecraft on top of it. And actually, I think it was President Eisenhower was president then. He forbid von Braun from trying to launch this rocket because he was afraid of offending the Soviet Union. That's according to stories I read. But of course, with Sputnik 1 launch, all that changed. And he and Van Allen collaborated to put an instrument on this spacecraft, which was later called Explorer 1. And the instrument was actually an instrument to study cosmic rays, which Van Allen was interested in.
Okay, so let's fast forward a little bit. As you go working under Dr. Van Allen, you become very interested in space plasma, and you really are considered one of the pioneering physicists when it comes to space plasma physics. So I'd like you to give us, as briefly as you can, some really basics about space plasma physics. But let's start with cosmic rays, because you've mentioned them before. What exactly are cosmic rays, or what do we know about them?
Well, cosmic rays were discovered, I think, in the 1930s or so. I don't know if I can give you the exact year, but essentially, if you take a Geiger counter, which I think most people probably heard of, and sit it out here in the table, it will click. And the clicking is caused by very high energy particles going through the counter. And when I say they're really high energy, what are the particles? Well, there's protons and helium atoms and other sometimes very heavy things like iron particles, very atoms. They're just moving at almost relativistic, almost at the speed of light. And these are going through your body all the time. And really, even up to the present time, these are coming from outer space. And even to the present time, it's not completely understood how these particles gain their tremendous energy. There are some good theories, but I don't think you probably want to go into all that. So that was what Van Allen was really interested in studying with his instrument on Explorer 1. However, he discovered the radiation belt of the Earth, which was a totally unexpected thing that has intensities that can be 10,000 times greater than the intensity of cosmic rays. In fact, it's quite dangerous for an astronaut to fly at certain altitudes in the radiation belt.
Yeah. Well, and when the Apollo astronauts were going to the moon, they had to fly through them. And I know there was some worry about that.
That is correct.
But is this too simplistic, but is it just that they're passing through at high speed and not spending a lot of time, you know, there, that, the, you know, kind of like passing your finger through a flame, you don't get burned? Is that why that worked out okay?
Well, I should tell you that in some respects, there's different aspects of cosmic rays. There are some cosmic rays that come from great distances out in the galaxy or throughout the universe, probably. We also get what are sometimes loosely called cosmic rays from the sun. You get explosions from the sun, and there are these high energy particles, I'll use that term instead of cosmic rays, come out from the sun, and they take about 8 to 10 minutes to get from the sun to the Earth. And that's what the astronauts that flew to the moon, they were really potentially in danger of a explosion on the sun. We often call them solar flares that would put out these very high intensities and frankly would kill an astronaut on the way to the moon. That's just true. Unfortunately, no such event happened when they went to the moon. They don't happen all that often, but that is a risk for any astronaut flying, say, well beyond the Earth. It turns out the Earth's magnetic field protects us to some degree from those solar events.
Well, when you were studying plasma physics there at the University of Iowa, that becomes like your lifelong work. And I would like you to give us just some of the basics, you know, for our listeners, to explain, you know, simply, what is plasma?
Well, a plasma, we're of course familiar with an ordinary gas. We're speaking here with, you know, we breathe oxygen and so forth. I'm going to call that that type of gas in our atmosphere is what I call a neutral atmosphere. The atoms that make up the gas are not electrically charged. Now, under some circumstance, which I'll explain, you can get the electron torn away from the atom so that you get electrons and positively charged nuclei. And that's a plasma. So basically, a plasma is an ionized gas. It consists of charged particles. And now we don't, down here where we're breathing in the atmosphere, that's mostly a neutral atmosphere. And that gets into a little bit, how do you produce a plasma? Well, there's two ways, actually. One is to heat an ordinary gas up to a really high temperature, like happens in a flame. Or let's say an arc welder, you know, somebody doing a welding, you run an electrical current from the arc welder through the atmosphere, and it creates that bright light, and that's actually a plasma. Fluorescent light tubes have an electrical current going through them, and that's a plasma. So there's kind of things in everyday life. In fact, some displays on computers are plasma, but I better not go into how that's produced. That's kind of technical.
Let's take a short break, but stay with us as we continue our conversation with retired University of Iowa physics professor Donald Gurnett as we talk about his career as one of America's leading space scientists. I'm Dave Schlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back. Let's return now to my interview with Don Gurnett. Dr. Gurnett had a long and distinguished career at the University of Iowa before retiring there in 2019. The pinnacle of his life's research work was being a part of the Voyager science team from the launch of the missions in 1977 to today as the twin spacecraft explore interstellar space. Okay, so plasma is often called the fourth state of matter. You got solid, liquid, gas, and then plasma. Why is it that plasma in space is such an important and interesting thing to study?
Well, I should say that one way a plasma is produced is by ultraviolet light from the sun. And you know, ultraviolet light will give you sunburn. Well, when ultraviolet light shines on a neutral atmosphere, the photons that make up the ultraviolet light can break the atom up into an electron and a positively charged. So that's when, if you go up high enough in the Earth's atmosphere above about 100 kilometers, you get into a region called the ionosphere, and that's created by ultraviolet light ionizing our neutral atmosphere. And you start getting a very dense plasma up there. It turns out that almost anything in space, if you think of going above our atmosphere, almost everything in the universe is ionized. In fact, there are rough estimates that 99% of the entire universe consists of a plasma. So from a standpoint of space research, plasmas are very important. Almost everything consists of a plasma. The sun, for example. And all the gas in between the sun and going out into interstellar space is made up of a significant amount of plasma. And the big difference is a plasma can carry an electrical current. Our neutral atmosphere does not carry an electrical current very well. And this then ties it in with all kinds of interesting physics things, magnetic fields and electric fields and things like that. And that's the kind of thing. In fact, our Van Allen radiation belt is a plasma. It's just an extremely energetic plasma of electrons and ions.
And what was the first mission you ever got involved with, if you can call it a mission, experiment, where you got to fly instruments aboard a rocket?
Well, actually, my involvement in plasmas came about somewhat accidentally. When I arrived and started working for Van Allen, there was some other professors there that had just recently been hired, especially a guy by the name of Brian O'Brien. The University of Iowa, we were the first university of Iowa to build an entire spacecraft. And being involved in electronics, I quickly got involved in that kind of thing, and I started designing digital data systems. And so I was really functioning as an engineer during those very early days when I was still an undergraduate. But as it turned out, there was a guy that came from the National Bureau of Standards, came here and gave a seminar. And he played some recordings of some very unusual radio sounds that came from space. And people just didn't know very well how these were produced. And I got interested in that, and I actually developed a radio receiver, a low-frequency radio receiver. And that's what I mean by low-frequency down in actually the audio range. You might call it just a simple electrical amplifier. And if you hook that up to a certain type of antenna, you can detect these unusual space radio sounds. And I built an instrument like that. I suggested to Van Allen, along with this other professor, Brian O'Brien, that we fly it on this spacecraft that I was working on. And we flew it. It was launched successfully in 1961, and when we turned it on, we heard all these strange whistling sounds from space, and that turns out plasma is very, very important to understand how these radio sounds are produced, and that's what got me into plasma physics, and I was still an undergraduate when that was going on.
Well, those whistling sounds, the whistlers, can you play one of those for us?
Yes, I can. In fact, I'm going to play here. This instrument I developed, which was on a University of Iowa spacecraft, it could transmit the sounds to the ground. And I can remember to this day when we commanded the transmitter on and we heard all these strange sounds. One of them is called whistlers. And it was actually known at that time how they're produced. When a lightning stroke goes off, it emits radio signals. You can actually hear that in your car radio during a thunderstorm. You can hear these kind of crashes. I call them crashes or something on the static. And it turns out in this plasma, this ionospheric plasma, the high frequencies travel faster than the low frequencies. And when a lightning stroke goes off, the high frequencies get there first, and with a noticeable time delay of sometimes several seconds, the lower frequencies get there. So you get a whistling sound. It kind of goes. I didn't mimic that very well, but I'm going to play right now signals that were recorded from my instrument on that early spacecraft. Okay, I'll play them now. We're going over a thunderstorm here, and each of these whistling sound is produced by a lightning, a bolt of lightning.
Wow, that's cool. That's the first time we ever heard those, right?
Well, from space, they had been heard on the ground, but not from space before.
And then there's another phenomenon that I read about from you called the Dawn Chorus. Do you have a recording of that?
Yeah, this is a very interesting thing because this had been heard on the ground also, and it was called Dawn Chorus. And the reason for that is it's a British term that when the birds wake up in the morning and they start singing, they call that the dawn chorus. And so we knew this existed. You could hear it on the ground. But for the first time with this University of Iowa spacecraft, we orbited in the Van Allen radiation belt, and we heard these same sounds, and I'll play them for you now. They're kind of rising tones, and they're not produced by lightning. I'll get to how they're produced in just a minute.
They almost remind me of like whale sounds.
Yeah, there are whale sounds, and there's a similarity, maybe not close, but I'll tell you, it didn't take us very long studying this dawn chorus to discover that it reached the maximum intensity in the outer Van Allen radiation belt. And that was the first real connection between the electrons in the outer radiation belt and the generation of this space sound. And this turns out to be a very interesting topic in plasma physics. I suppose you don't want a long lecture on this, but basically, you got these very energetic electrons in the radiation belt, and they cooperatively get together in synchronous and generate these sounds. I know that's kind of hard to explain, but that's what it does. And there are people to this day still studying the physics of this this kind of spontaneously generated sound from the Van Allen radiation belts.
Wow. And over your career, how many like instruments have you designed or been a part of at least, and how many different missions have you been involved with? Because you've been involved with a lot.
I have been involved a lot. I'm not. This count gets to be kind of hard to do because some of them have failed and various things like that.
Give us a ballpark.
If you count various instruments, including electronic development that I've been involved in, I think I've been involved in 2/3 of the spacecraft that were ever built at Iowa, or even instruments for spacecraft. And that's about 35 or so, give or take a few, depending on how you want to count things. And we've flown these kind of instruments to almost every planet in the solar system. Especially Jupiter. I eventually proposed and had an instrument very similar to what we flew on that very first Iowa spacecraft. We proposed and got an instrument of this type flown on the Voyager spacecraft, which is a really, really tremendous mission, of which I'm extremely proud of. And we flew to Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. And then we eventually reached interstellar space. Which we're studying now, and that was launched in 77, which I think, if I do the math right, is 44 years ago.
Yeah, and you know, out of all those missions, I know for you personally, and for you know a lot of space history buffs like myself, Voyager really does stand out. What is it about Voyager, you think, that really, you know, for you, you know, it is the pinnacle?
Well, it has gone to regions where no human-made object has ever gone before. Interstellar space being the prime example. This is the only spacecraft that's ever gone beyond the influence of the sun, what we call the heliosphere, into interstellar space. And at the planets, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, it made the first really high-resolution pictures. And of course, I wasn't directly involved in that, but I was involved in the sense of being there. And I later taught astronomy, and I could speak to my students about these planets as having been there practically, I can't say at the discovery, but at the first time that really we studied close-up pictures of all this curious things. You know, like there's a moon Titan at Saturn that has a dense nitrogen atmosphere. The only object in the entire solar system other than Earth that has a nitrogen atmosphere. Go figure. So I could lecture with some authority about having been involved with other people on the study of these many of these strange things we have in the in our solar system.
Yeah, and then of course, when I first got to know you was when Voyager first crossed into interstellar space, and so I'd like you to kind of take us through that, if you will, about how did you find out? How did we know that Voyager had crossed what's called the heliopause? So let's start there. What is the heliopause, and what makes that special to be able to go through that?
Well, the heliopause is a concept, started out as kind of a concept that way back in, I think it was 1955, a guy by the name of Davis, that was when there was the first hint of a gas flowing out from the sun that we call the solar wind. The first hints were actually from some effects on comets, which suggested there was this very high-speed gas flowing at almost a million miles an hour from the sun. That was later confirmed by direct spacecraft observation that such a solar wind did exist. And you know how scientists are when they discover something like this, well, they ask, well, how does the solar wind finally end if it's blowing out from the sun? And so it was sort of postulated that the solar wind would eventually be stopped by the interstellar medium out there. And you have to think of the following concept. As the solar wind expands radially from the sun, the density has to go down. That's because it's spreading into a bigger and bigger volume all the time. And so since the density goes down, the ram pressure of the solar wind would decrease. Now, let me say what ram pressure is. If you're driving in a car and you put your hand out the window, you can feel, right, the pressure on your hand. Well, the solar wind has a ram pressure like that, and that pressure would go down. And so at some point out there, the ram pressure of the solar wind would equal the pressure of the interstellar medium. The only thing is we didn't have any idea. I think I'd put it almost that generally, what the density of the interstellar medium was. And so people start speculating, and I'll put it at nothing more than speculation, as to where that boundary would be. And some of my very good friends, actually, in the early days, proposed it was like 5 astronomical units. That's at the orbit of Jupiter. Well, I'll have to tell you, we flew by Jupiter with Voyager, and so did Pioneer 10 and 11, and there was no boundary there. All we knew was it was farther and farther out. Now, in 1983, our instrument on Voyager detected a rather intense radio event at the frequencies of 2 to 3 kilohertz. This was actually in the audio frequency range. And this was a radio emission, and we didn't know where it came from. And that remained a big mystery until about 11 years later, we detected another big radio emission. And that one gave us the big clue. And I can play the sounds for you if you want.
Yeah, and that's like a plasma wave from the sun. Is that what those are?
I wouldn't call it a plasma wave. We have to make some careful distinctions here. What we discovered with this big event, radio event in 1992, was that about a year earlier, there was a tremendous solar flare, series of solar flares at the sun that sent out a burst of gas from the sun and a shockwave that went by the Earth. It went by a whole fleet of other spacecraft like Pioneer 10 and 11, went by Voyager 1, Voyager 2. And they were at various distances, so we could estimate the speed of the shockwave, which was about, well, it was hard to get an exact number, but 800 to 1,000 kilometers per second. That's in the range of a million or a few million miles an hour. Really, really high velocity. Well, what we discovered is that about a year later, actually 100 and some days, we detected this big radio burst. So we published a paper in 1993 making the claim that that radio burst was caused by this shockwave when it finally reached the heliopause, the boundary between the interstellar plasma and the heliosphere, and made this radio emission. And from that, I could predict the distance to the heliosphere, which nobody else knew. Actually, I'll have to say there were other people guessed, but nobody had a good idea. And our calculation was based on a very simple idea. The distance is equal to velocity times time. Have you heard of that?
Yep. Rate times time equals distance. I think I learned that in fourth grade.
Right. That's a very solid principle. So we had the speed of the shockwave, and it took 100 and some days to get there, and I worked that out, and we came up with a number of about 116 astronomical units up to maybe as much as 170 astronomical units. Now, I know you astronomical units is just distance between the sun and the Earth, but let me tell you, that was a long ways out there, and
yeah, because like to Jupiter, the outermost planet, Pluto, is like 38, 39 astronomical units.
Yeah, 39, right. So it's way beyond Pluto. It's
way beyond Pluto.
And I'll have to tell you, I think you can probably read various stories about this whole thing in the press and so forth. But my colleagues, as I described it, were polite, but I don't think they believed it. And because it was kind of an esoteric idea, especially that when the shockwave interacted with the helios, the heliopause, it would create a radio emission. But we had good arguments for that, actually. So no, a lot of people didn't believe it. I think I would characterize it that. Well, one of the reasons was that at that point, Voyager was only at about 45, I think, AU from the sun, not even halfway out to the heliosphere. And if I was right on that, it would take another 20 years for the spacecraft to get to the heliopause. And nobody really wanted to believe that. And not only that, Voyager was under some financial pressure at that point. They were talking actually somewhat seriously about canceling the mission,
turning it off.
Yeah, and if we came out and said it's going to take another 20 years, There was a question whether they wanted to fund the mission for that long. Well, time went by and they did fund the mission. I have to say, most of my colleagues, that we would have scientific meetings and they would vote on where they thought the heliopause was. And often the estimate was maybe another 10 AU beyond where the spacecraft was at, which of course wasn't correct at all, as it turned out. And finally, in 2012, we reached the heliopause and we went into the interstellar medium and we detected these electron plasma oscillations, which was involved in the radio emission process. And so my whole story turned out to be correct. And I believe that's true today.
Wow. That's quite a vindication. Okay, Don, can you play some of those amazing radio bursts that you've been telling us about from the 80s and 90s?
Yeah, the first one I'll play, this will actually be one recording, but it actually starts when Voyager's at 15 astronomical units, nowhere close to the heliopause. And we detected a very intense, quite intense radio event that we didn't know where it was coming from. So I'll start the recording and you'll hear this. It's first it's very quiet, then you'll hear the event. That's the first event. Could you hear it okay?
Yeah, I could hear it.
Now you'll hear some kind of very weak events here. And remember, we're going by a year about every 10 seconds here.
Wow.
Can you hear there's something going on right now? Now we're coming up to the 92 event.
Wow.
And that event lasted 3 years. Well, what we discovered was that last event, the start of the event was about 100 days before we had detected with other instruments a very intense shockwave coming out from the sun from a series of solar flares. And I actually, in our paper in 93, we made the proposition that that shockwave kept going for 100 and some days. And finally contacted the heliopause out there, where it made this a very intense radio emission in 1992. And that hypothesis turned out to be correct when we finally, almost 20 years later, finally got out to the heliopause.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us as we continue our conversation with space plasma physicist Donald Gurnett as we talk about the Voyager missions and interstellar space and the strange sounds of lightning in Jupiter. And we're back. If you're just joining us, our guest is Donald Gurnett. Don retired after 60 years as a student, teacher, and researcher at the University of Iowa. He's one of the pioneers in the field of space plasma physics and is a member of the Voyager Interstellar Mission science team. What are some of the things that you've learned about the interstellar medium that we didn't know before?
Well, when we finally crossed the heliopause, we detected these things we call electron plasma oscillations. They're basically a vibration in the plasma that is caused by electrons streaming out ahead of the shockwave. Fairly esoteric process, but we understand that. And this vibration of the electrons, we call it a plasma oscillation, gave us a density. There's just a very well-known formula for converting the frequency of the plasma oscillation to the electron density. So for the first time, we could measure the plasma density, the electron density, I'll call it, out in the interstellar medium. And the striking thing is, for example, that when we went from the heliosphere, that's inside the heliopause, when we crossed the heliopause, the density went up almost a factor of 50. That seemed to many people to be counterintuitive, but it's actually very reasonable from a plasma physics point of view. The inner part of the heliosphere inside the heliopause is very hot. It's almost 100,000 to a million degrees. And when you go into the interstellar medium, it's much colder, about 10,000 degrees. So you have to have pressure balance across the heliopause. And that means the number density times the temperature has to be the same on both sides. So as the temperature drops going into the interstellar medium, the density has to go up by a very large factor. And we directly detected that. And I think that's what finally convinced everybody that we knew what we were doing and that we were really in the interstellar space.
So out of all the amazing things you've been involved with, like, you know, detecting lightning and Jupiter and all those early studies of the near space environment with just the whistlers being recorded and the dawn chorus and all those things, where does crossing into interstellar space and being able to verify that, where does that rank for you all time?
Well, for me, I think it's probably ranks as one of the best accomplishments, not only of myself, but all the other people who worked with me on this. So yeah, it ranks very high in my mind.
Well, it's amazing to me to think that Voyager, launched in 1977, is still doing meaningful science.
It is amazing. I agree. I don't think, I know that when we reached Jupiter, I'd never really thought that we would actually get out into interstellar space some, let's see how many years later, that was 30, some more than 30 years later, and still be working on Voyager. It's pretty amazing. I will say, though, that in our proposal, which we sent to NASA, we did discuss in our proposal eventually reaching interstellar space. So we did have that foresight, but I don't think many of us didn't think it would take this long to get out there. And that's because the heliopause was much farther away than anybody thought back in 1977.
Well, before we let you go, looking back on your long teaching career, you taught, you know, kind of every level of class there at the University of Iowa, from the top level plasma physics, very intense high-level courses, down to general astronomy. And I'm just wondering, what were some of your favorite things about teaching those kinds of classes?
Well, I enjoyed teaching really a lot, I have to say. And I think I've worked with something like, on thesis projects, with something like 30-some graduate students. And I've had graduate students that became very high, prominent members in NASA, and a lot of people have done very well. So I think somebody at some award ceremony pointed out that I'd taught 25 or something like 20 different classes, completely different classes.
Wow.
And for example, I taught astronomy of different levels. And I never in my entire life took an astronomy course, but I would share that with the students on the first day of class. And I'll have to say, it's been my experience with Voyager, being there at the time of discovery of especially the outer planets and various planets in the solar system, that gave me kind of direct knowledge about how things were, what things were like at that. So it isn't that I spent a time in my career studying these plans as a student. It's just that that became my interest as I became a professor.
Yeah, well, you had a front row seat to all of that.
Thank you.
Literally.
You did.
And, well, it's been a delight to talk to you, Don, and congratulations on the retirement. And I know, like every brilliant retired person, you're going to be busier than ever.
I am very busy now. I have to tell you, that is just simply the truth.
And now on Blue Dot, it's time for the teachable moment, when from time to time, our producer and engineer, the maestro, Matt Fidler, asks me a question, and we see if we can maybe straighten something out for him and you, the listener. So, Matt, what's on your mind?
Well, this is kind of a weird subject, because I feel like a lot of people get ostracized for even talking about that, but it's UFOs, or what I guess they're now calling unidentified aerial phenomenon. There's this report that basically was put into a law that Congress had to make a report about kind of all these unidentified aerial phenomenon sightings. And they can't seem to be explained. And of course, lots of us are hoping maybe this is extraterrestrial life and they're going to confirm everything I believed and come down and say, here's how you do interstellar travel. And here's the secret to the universe. And, you know, I don't know, guide Earth into a better place. And I don't know. That's where my hopes go with the idea of aliens. And, you know, Stephen Hawking believed that there had to be life outside of our planet. And I think a lot of people are hoping that this report was to give this incredible life to, yeah, the idea that we're not alone in the universe.
Yeah.
What does this report actually say?
Well, before we go any further, there's a flip side to that, you know, wanting the aliens to give you all the answers. And, you know, if you look at the history of life on Earth, whenever a civilization that is more technically advanced than another one contacts it, the results for the one that is not as technically advanced are always disastrous.
Yeah, that is kind of scary. I just hope that aliens would be better than us humans that way. But yeah, but why would I think that?
but there's no reason to expect that. So, you know.
Good point. Good point.
There's, you know, that's kind of wishful thinking.
Okay, so whether or not the aliens are going to be our saviors or not.
Yeah, my big takeaway is that, you know, this report that came out on unidentified aerial phenomenon, there's nothing in it that points that this is aliens. There's nothing in it that says that. And I'm not an expert on this, but I know somebody who is an astrobiologist and who's been delving into these matters for many years, and he can give us a very good scientific take on this. David Grinspoon. So, let's see what he has to say about it.
Yeah, so UFOs, or now they're calling them UAPs, unidentified aerial phenomena. I don't see any reason to really think that they're related to the subject of my expertise, which is astrobiology and extraterrestrial intelligence. I mean, they could be, but I haven't seen, you know, just because there's some blurry things that have been showing up on some radar of some aircraft. I mean, it's interesting. I would like them to be investigated. I'd be very interested in understanding more about them, but nothing about them screams out to me, these must be alien spacecraft.
Yeah. It makes you wonder what we could do to find out more about them. Like what these phenomena are.
Yeah. I mean, the first thing I wonder is if they really are things or if they're just sort of artifacts in some radar systems or camera systems of aircraft, which we know those kinds of things happen, which isn't to say I don't know enough about this to say that I'm sure of that. But that's my first question is, are they really things at all, as opposed to just instrumental artifacts? And if they are things, then yeah, I mean, I would love to learn more about them. Certainly, we know there are natural phenomena that are very strange that we haven't identified. I mean, think of these weird, super high altitude lightning flashes called sprites, mm-hmm. That were only discovered a few years ago. Even though we've been, you know, doing supposedly high tech observations of Earth from orbit and from the ground and from the air for decades, you know, there are obviously still fairly substantial natural phenomena that we're still just discovering. So it could be something like that. I'm not saying I know for sure that these aren't some advanced technology that we don't understand. If they are, I'd suspect they're from Earth rather than from elsewhere. But, you know, one has to be open-minded. But as Carl Sagan said at one point, keep your mind open, but not so open that your brains fall out.
Yeah, exactly. And when you were, you know, you talking about they could be some kind of artifact of the technology of the radar and imaging systems, you know, you always got to kind of fall back on Occam's razor that, you know, that simplest explanation usually is the one that turns out to be correct.
That's right. Another quote that I love is, I think it's Bertrand Russell said, when one admits that anything is possible, one must quickly add that some things are much less probable than others.
So anyway, Matt, that's what David said is about what I expected. What they are and what they could be, you know, is still, you know, literally up in the air.
Ha ha. Well, I do like that there are always things we don't know, which means there's always things to look forward to learning about.
Yeah, that's what the fun part of science is. It's like, I don't know what this mystery is. Let's investigate.
Right on. So that's not entirely disappointing.
Well, it's a mystery. And, you know, mysteries are kind of cool. That's part of the fun part of science is investigating mysteries.
In life.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, thanks, Dave.
You're welcome. And thanks, David Grinspoon. Thanks again to our guests, retired University of Iowa Professor Donald Gurnett, and special thanks to David Grinspoon for popping in to help out on the Teachable Moment. And thanks to you for listening. Never miss an episode. Subscribe to our podcast on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of CAP Radio, and is distributed by PRX. If you live outside NorCal and like the show, let your local NPR station know you'd like to hear it on the air. Blue Dot is produced and engineered by the maestro, Matt Fidler. Our associate producer and owner of A Dog Named Rocket is Ellie Johnson. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.